Hello, I'm Mark Steiner, and welcome on this cold and not snowy, but snow-filled Tuesday. This first hour is one of our Urbanite radio stories. As you know, our print partner is Urbanite Magazine, and they have their February issue out. And we're going to have a number of conversations about this issue over the course of the next month, even beyond February. And the issue is called After Race. More than a half century after the end of legal segregation, it still defines how we live in the city, but not for long, the subtitle says. And we're going to talk about one of those articles that was in this issue. This may be a part one and two. This is part one of that discussion. Part two may take place with some of the people that were actually in the article. Who live in an East Baltimore neighborhood, written by Joan Jacobson. It was her article. And Joan Jacobson is a former Sun and Evening Sun reporter. She's covered housing in neighborhoods for 20 years in this city. And she wrote the article called The Color Line. We're also joined in studio by James Crockett, a man who I've known for many, many, many moons, who is the first black member of the Maryland Real Estate Commission. He's current president of the Baltimore Board of Fire Commissioners, and he was one of Baltimore City's first firemen, who was African-American fireman in the city, and Jim Crockett, and a real estate businessman, has his own company. Jim, good to see you as always.
Nice to see you, Mark.
Good to see you in studio.
Yes,
instead of on the phone.
Thank you.
And Anthro Pietila is with us. Anthro is, of course, a former great Sun reporter and writer and editorialist, and he's author of the new book, Not in My Neighborhood, How the Race Shaped a Great American City, a book that we will have him back on to talk about by himself. But right now, he's part of this panel discussion. And Anthro, welcome.
Good Thank you so much.
And Joan, good to have all of you with us. So, Joan, let's talk. And folks, you can join us here at 410-319-8888. One of the things I want you all to contemplate as you hear this conversation going and join us with your thoughts and ideas at 410-319-8888 is the nature of segregation in the city and your own remembrances from childhood on to your ideas about where we are now. How many of you out there live in neighborhoods that are homogeneous, all black, all Ukrainian, all Jamaican, all Jewish, all whatever? Or how many of you really live in neighborhoods that are racially mixed? And we'll talk about that and more in the course of this hour and what you think of that part of our society. And we're going to talk a lot about history in the course of this hour and the history of why Baltimore was always known as one of the most segregated cities in America and what those historical roots are. And is that changing? 410-319-8888 is the number. Joan Jacobson, you launched this discussion with this article. Talk a bit about that.
Well, I spoke to David Dudley, the Urbanite editor, and he asked me to find one city block with people of different races and go and talk to them. And we didn't want to prejudge what we would find. We weren't looking for a block where everybody loved each other or everybody hated each other. We just wanted a dialogue. So I went to look in East Baltimore, figuring there would be more than two races, and spoke with a man named Ed Rakowski, who's very involved in transforming the Patterson Park area. And he suggested a woman, a young woman, her name is Shanaysha Sauls, who's a political science professor at American University who lives on the 3,000 block of East Baltimore Street. And I called her, and she was very welcoming, and I went over there and started to interview her, her husband, the neighbors, and found this wonderfully progressive group of people. They were wonderful to talk to, and even the oldest neighbor in the block, an elderly Greek woman who had lived there for more than 50 years, recalled that when she first moved there, the neighbors who were mostly German wouldn't speak to her. And she stayed while they all moved away, and she says that she thinks the neighborhood is better than ever and is very comfortable with these neighbors, the Sauls. They look after her. And it was just every conversation I had with anyone was just wonderful about race, very forward-thinking.
So now your book, Anthro, it wasn't in the article itself, but you had a little piece in the online for them. And your book examines the segregation in the city. You have a tripart segregation in Baltimore, the way you tell the history, black, white, and Jewish. And you see the roots of that being very conscious, very historical, and that we are still in many ways rooted in that world from your perspective.
We are very much rooted in that world. Baltimore in 1910 was the first city in the United States to require by law that each residential block be segregated according to the majority race. Now, what is so fantastic about the block that Joan Jacobson has found is that it is not only very unusual in the segregated city, still very segregated city, but it may be an indication as to where this nation and Baltimore may be going. And I'm saying this for the following reason. We are now seeing a totally revolutionary generational change in which the incoming generation, the millennial generation, born between 1984 and 2002, they are unlike any generation in this nation's history. They are 45% non-white, black, mixed-race, Asian, Latinos, all kinds of people who are not classified as white by the society. And to indicate how revolutionary this is, that currently, in the current generation, the non-white portion is only 25%. So,
of the millennials.
It's 45 among the millennials, right. And in the current generation, in the past generation,
it is
25%.
Right.
So we are in the throes of this change, and I think that Joan's article is a good example of how things may be going if things go right. Now, at the same time, another thing that was interesting in Joan's article was that most everybody in that block was not from Baltimore. They were from someplace else.
Uh-huh. That's very interesting. And I'm going to tie these things together here in a minute. But Jim Crockett, let me talk a bit about your past and history. And before you came in, Joan and I were talking about how I remember as a young kid in Baltimore when formerly all Jewish neighborhoods started having their first black folks and moving into those neighborhoods buying homes. And it wasn't just Jewish neighborhoods, white neighborhoods in general. And you led a campaign at that point. Talk a bit about that history for our listeners who may not know it, to ban the sale signs in neighborhoods.
The city of Baltimore is a city of neighborhoods. And I think it started with the industrial industry of bringing Irish people over to work in the factories around the B&O Railroad and providing housing for them in what we call alley streets. I think that was the start of it. And blacks that worked in the neighborhood could walk the laundry or mind the children or whatever. They built houses for them too. And as a result of that, the industries like Hooper's Mills and all places like that, they had places where they did not pay the employees money. They gave them scrip. They had company stores. You bought your clothes, your food, and everything there. Still an example of that is on Druid Park Drive. As you go out to Union Avenue, you'll see the buildings. So I think that was the beginning of it. And blacks lived in all sections of the city of Baltimore in black areas, all over the city, in Pimlico. In the 30s, blacks lived in Pimlico on certain streets. So it was a matter of the Second World War that opened up the housing to blacks in the city of Baltimore.
But now talk a bit about the campaign that you led, the ban for sale signs, what year that was.
That was in 1978. Mayor Schaefer was the mayor of Baltimore. And being in the real estate industry, a lot of people drive by neighborhoods and look at signs and want to visit the house to see what it's like. And the city of Baltimore came up with a ban on signs. They wanted you to take the signs down. I owned a house at 1929 McCullough Street. And I left my sign up, and Schaefer took me to court. And it did not end at that one court. It went all the way to the Supreme Court. And on March the 1st, 1981, the Supreme Court rendered in my favor, and people start putting signs on houses again.
I wonder at that point in our history, we call that a period of white flight, right? When black folks moved in the neighborhood, white people started putting sale signs up and leaving, and so the response was from the city government not to put for sale signs up in people's neighborhoods. And to me, it was kind of a relatively typical top-down, almost absurdist government policy that you challenged because you had a house to sell.
Right.
But go ahead, Jim.
But you had two industries. You had a black industry called realtors because they could not join the realtors. And it was the realtors that had an unwritten law that they would not sell to black people. And they had the majority of the homes, and they also had multiple listing working for them. And no blacks could join multiple listing, so you had to use signs in order to sell your properties.
And also it was that period of time and before that you had county executives in Baltimore County that you write about in your book, like Dale Anderson, who actually wanted somebody to report somebody if they sold a house to somebody black, right?
That's right, and I think that what it really underscores is the inability of this community, whether it was in the city or in the county, to agree on a couple of concepts. Number one, on the speed and desirability of desegregation. For that reason, when we talk about blockbusting, for instance, panic selling, lots of people regard people like our friend Jim Crockett here as a blockbuster only because he was an instrument in racial change. I mean, there was this very, very deeply felt refusal to desegregate, even though as early as in 1948, the Supreme Court had declared restrictive covenants, racial restrictive covenants, unenforceable. But the community was not ready to do it.
So, I mean, communities in Baltimore are always reluctant to do those things. I mean, that's always been the case. I mean, you've been covering housing for how long? How long did you cover housing in the Sun?
I covered housing for about 20 years, from the late 70s to the 90s. Sure, it was all very segregated and, you know, different than it is now.
But I'm curious from our listeners again, 410-319-8888, your own experience with housing in this community. If you're of an older generation and you're late 40s to your 70s, maybe you'll recall when neighborhoods, as we say in Baltimore, began to change, which was the euphemism people used when going from white to black, and what that meant for the city, what it meant for your own personal experiences, and this whole idea of white flight and people moving out. But I as we get these calls in at 410-319-8888, I want to just take a couple of minutes and have, I guess, Anthro, you might be, but since you put it in your book, is to talk a bit about, and you put it in that small piece you wrote on the Urbanite website that just was attached to this article, about the legal roots in the early 20th century, where Baltimore became the flagship city in terms of teaching the rest of the country how to officially segregate their cities.
Well, in 1910, a very significant black lawyer who is now totally forgotten, Ashby Hawkins, bought a house at 1834 McCullough Street, and all hell broke loose. It was just a couple of blocks from Utah Place, which was one of the prestige areas. And as a result of this, the city council passed a law that required that each block be segregated. Now, the Supreme Court then, in 1917, throughout that approach. Meanwhile, another instrument that had been introduced in Baltimore had been used in some other cities as well, then became the instrument of choice in segregating, and that was called restrictive covenants. Homeowners bandied together and they just wrote an agreement saying, well, this and this and this are the groups of people we don't like. And then they listed them, and these were part of their deed, so that they transferred from one owner to the next. And so this was declared unenforceable in 1948. Unenforceable meaning that if you and I want to ban Finns from, I happen to come from Finland, want to ban Finns from our neighborhoods, we can legally do it, but courts are not going to enforce it. And so then there was a series of these kinds of things, and what basically then became the document that held all this together was the 1937 redlining by the Federal Housing Administration of 239 American cities, including Baltimore. And so suddenly the federal government told banks that needed no telling, because they had been doing this all along, that there were certain neighborhoods like Guilford and Homeland and Rogers Forge where loans should be made. And then there were four categories. Then there were another good category. And then there were two categories, one transitional and the last one red, meaning redlining. And so this is how we operated until the 1960s, perhaps into the early 1970s.
So why do you think that we are still such a segregated city? Why is the block that you looked at, Joan Jacobson, such an anomaly?
Well, it's an anomaly because where it is. You have Canton to the south, and many young people can't afford to live in Canton, and so they kept looking north. And that's how some of them ended up on that block, because the prices were very reasonable. You also have that part of the city having an influx of people from Latin American countries and from African countries. And Edward Kowski from Patterson Park points out that when you start adding different, more races, the black-white schism isn't so obvious anymore. It isn't so important when you add other races. And I think those are some of the elements that played out there.
But I mean, we still have a community here that's kind of very separated in Baltimore. And I'm curious why you all think, and what our listeners think, at 410-319-8888 is after 100 years after these laws were put in place in 1910, 100 years making Baltimore officially a segregated city and denying black folks the right to vote and all the things those laws did when they were passed. Why those roots, where you think the connection is between those roots 100 years ago and where we are now?
Well, since we are on the Morgan campus, Morgan, when it moved to this location here in Northeast Baltimore, also developed a residential neighborhood, one of the handful of residential neighborhoods that were developed for blacks. And Morgan at that time was run by a white president and a white board. They hired a white real estate man counsel them in this development. He insisted on covenants. As a result, Morgan Park banned whites. So, I mean, it was just it became something that people expected. And I think that there is a very interesting article in the issue of The Urbanite by this black professor who talks about why he lives in an all-black neighborhood. And there was this concept that Gunnar Myrdal, the famous Swedish sociologist, introduced in 1944. He talked about voluntary withdrawal. People withdrawing because they did, for whatever reason, they did not feel comfortable with people who looked or acted different from them.
But that's, go ahead, Jim.
The other part to that is, not too far from here is a section that's called Wilson Park that was developed by Harry O. Wilson, who was in the insurance business. And whites were excluded from living in Wilson Park, the same as Morgan Park.
And what year was that?
I guess it started somewhere around the early 30s, the late 20s.
He bought the land in 1917 for a very interesting reason. The land was desirable, but in the jingoistic mood of World War I, no white buyers wanted to deal with a person of German origin who owned the land. So Harry Wilson having money, entered the negotiations and bought the land. So one prejudice building on another.
But Harry Wilson was African-American.
Yeah. Yes.
And his money came from where?
Insurance.
Insurance.
He had two boys. And both of these boys went to Polly in the 20s.
But Polly?
There is no record of blacks entering Polly.
Until
1953.
But his kids went to Polly?
Went to Polly. In fact, the two boys passed for white. The sister married Coger, Earl Coger Sr. Coger Sr.
Right.
And so she went to black schools and the boys went to white schools.
The boys went to Polly because they passed for white.
They went to Polly.
That's a fascinating story in its own right. 410-319-8888. I'll hear more about that story another day. 410-319-8888 is the number here. Reverend Meredith, you're on the phone. You're on the air.
Yes, hello. How are you?
Welcome. Well, thank you.
I was just calling because I recently moved to Charles Village, but I used to live on Greenmount Avenue. So I find it very interesting that this article, which talks about, you know, the desegregation of Baltimore. Honestly, I've lived here for a total of almost 15 years, and I see it in certain spots, but I still see a lot of black and white folks in poverty in segregated neighborhoods. I also see a lot of rampant drug abuse. It's crazy. So, I mean, I guess that the article kind of does foreshadow some sort of change, but I don't know. It's just a lot of poverty here in Baltimore, a lot of hopelessness, and I wanted the panel to address those realities and how do we correct those?
Well, I don't know if we can really tackle the drug abuse issue today. We're going to kind of try to focus on housing, but but you still there, Reverend Meredith?
Say again.
I don't know. How do you describe your own neighborhood of Charles Village?
Oh, it's very mixed race. It's a college-based town. I mean, college-based area because Hopkins is right there. Morgan is down the street. And, you know, I just kind of feel like I enjoy living there. But, you know, when I was on Greenmount, it was a lot of stuff going on. There were a lot of things going on. And, I kind of had to move for my own comfort. You know, gang violence, rampant drug abuse. I mean, and rampant drug selling. So, I see the change, but I just, you know, where I live at, but, you know, in the black neighborhoods and neighborhoods like Pigtown and stuff,
right?
There's still a lot of drug abuse. And I don't know what's going on with that.
Reverend Meredith, thanks for your call. Number is 410-319-8888. And one of the things that Reverend Meredith was pointing out, it seems to me, is if there's even more happening now than used to, is class segregation as opposed to just racial segregation. One of the people in your article, Joan.
Yeah, I mean, even the people I talked to pointed out that class can be a bigger issue than race in the city now. And Baltimore does have an overwhelming number of very poor neighborhoods. And I think that's a result of a combination of federal policies and, frankly, the city administration's long-time disregard for the poorest of the poor. I mean, you talk about inclusionary housing laws. Well, the city's inclusionary housing law, for example, does nothing for the very poor, nothing at all. And it's a big problem. I agree with her.
I agree too, Mark. And maybe it's because of the city administration. When a neighborhood goes completely black, all of the services in that community just disappears. Immediately, it disappears. You can go to any of the sections that Ms. Jacobs is talking about. The alleys in East Baltimore are cleaner than the streets in West Baltimore. All you have to do is drive through.
Let's take it. We're going to say something before we take a break?
Yeah. Let me just talk about this in national terms. What has happened is a very interesting situation where, again, we are facing a totally uncertain future. As a result of subprime loans, blacks started moving to suburbs in unprecedented numbers. And so what we have now is we have all these neighborhoods full of foreclosed houses, and there is no telling what's going to happen there in terms of race or in terms of class. This is so totally different from Baltimore in the middle of the Great Depression, when there was absolutely no vacancies for any racial group whatsoever. So, yes, banks foreclosed and repossessed, but there were no vacant houses. There was no scramble to sell houses at auction. Banks simply rented them out, and there were takers.
In addition to that, Mark,
Jim Crockett,
the rents were $2 a week. I know of a house in Hall Street, which is two blocks long. It's right around the corner from Babe Ruth's home. The rent was $2 a week. People were paid $1 a day and car fare to go to work. They worked 8 hours a day. And many of the women saved the car fare in order to supplement the income for their families. You still have poverty areas like that, but you have subsidized housing by the federal government, which is a bad thing. They should use the form of 235 that would enable these people to buy the homes, and in 7 years, the government would be out of it. Here we have people that live on subsidized housing for 30, 40, 50 years, the second and third generation, and it's just a waste of money.
We're going to take a short break and come back, and I'm going to tackle some of these subjects and also talk about where I see in the metropolitan area real interracial neighborhoods taking place, and they're not in the city. 410-319-8888. You may live in them. I don't want to play a game with you. I'm talking about places like Pedonia, Timonium, parts of northeast in Baltimore County are the most interracial neighborhoods that I've stumbled across in any city in a long time, and that's a really interesting phenomenon. 410-319-8888. Cindy, Tommy, Jeff, we're going to come to your calls as soon as we come back from this very brief break. I want to remind you the Mark Steiner Show is made possible by Johns Hopkins Medicine. For the 19th consecutive year, the Johns Hopkins Hospital is ranked number one by U.S. News and World Report in their annual Best Hospital Survey. Find out more about the nation's top hospital at hopkinsmedicine.org. Welcome back. I'm Mark Steiner, and the Mark Steiner Show is made possible by the Maryland Parkinson's Disease and Movement Disorders Center, providing clinical research trials that evaluate new therapies and the latest treatment options, including surgical intervention for advanced stages of disease. The number for more information is 1-800-492-5538. You're listening to another one of our Urbanite radio broadcasts, and this hour we are having part one of Yoba's two-part series on the article by Joan Jacobson called The Color Line. We are joined by Joan Jacobson, who wrote the article. She's a former Baltimore Sun and Evening Sun reporter, covered housing in the neighborhood in neighborhoods for 20 years. Anthro Pietila is author of a new book called Not in My Neighborhood, How Race Shaped a Great American City, and covered the city for the Sun for a good 25 years or more, right?
35.
I know it's a long time, Anthro. And James Crockett is with us, who is in the real estate business. He's the first black member of the Maryland Real Estate Commission that was segregated for many, many years. We talked about it in the early part of our program. He's current president of the Baltimore Board of Fire Commissioners, and he was one of the first black firefighters in the city of Baltimore. The number here is 410-319-8888. Write to us here at steinershow@gmail.com. Let us go right to the phones. And Cindy in Baltimore, you're on the air.
Thank you, and thank you for your show. And I'm learning so much about this neighborhood. And I think that Wilson Park and Govins and Winston Radnor are so key to the health of the city and the community. And I just want to say that I find that neighborhood to be mixed white and black, not so much foreign. And that the real need right now is to push our legislators. We have three delegates and one state senator, Joan Carter Conway and Dory and Maggie McIntosh and Kurt Anderson. And we let them go to Annapolis and not necessarily do very much. When they come talk to us, they sound great. But we need to be going there to tell them, what are they doing about campaign finance reform? Are they pushing it through? What are they doing about the anti-death penalty bill? What are they doing about the single payer? You know, they need to be representing us as a it's one of the most progressive neighborhoods in the whole city. When you see the candidates come out, Uphold Methodist Church is filled up, and they ask great questions. They know what they're talking about.
But Cindy, so the focus of our show today is kind of our segregated neighborhoods is what we're trying to focus on.
I agree, but I don't think it's so segregated anymore. And I think
that's
more of a neighborhood, it needs to really start pushing its legislators. But anyways, I'd be glad to hear a show on that, too. Thank you very much.
Thank you so much. 410-319-8888, and Tommy in Baltimore, you're on the air.
Hello.
Hi, Tommy, you're on the air.
Great, thank you. I really appreciate this topic. It's a topic that's dear to my heart. And you have a brother, Crockett, on here.
Yep.
And he's going to testify to most of the things that happened from the black side. He spoke earlier about the realtors and the realtors. And I was born and bred in Baltimore. I love this town. I understand it from a standpoint that other people sort of don't believe, and modern generation does not believe. Baltimore is like it's paranoid schizophrenic. It was half slave and half free, where you could rent a man. And even used to have on a construction business, you go out and rent a man, do construction jobs. Same mentality, same formula. It's a duplication. I got in the real estate business in like 1961 and still, to a certain extent, keep my fingers attached to the real estate industry.
Mm-hmm.
It's a game. You know, it's really a game. It has some positives and it has some negatives. But it's about making money, not releasing control of a cash flow situation, a margin of profit that you can't beat anywhere. All you got to do is manipulate the pieces in and out of the game. And it's been controlled and dominated by a group of people. You understand? And it's all about collusion. They fight over turf. They do different things. They sold off the airport. They did a lot of things that was designed. And they infused whatever confusion that they wanted to infuse.
Let me ask our panel to come back in here for a moment. I mean, do we think that kind of collusion still exists?
Yes. And it started with the home builders of America. When they built homes, they realized that you could accumulate enough equity in your house within 7 years. So they did not permit blacks to buy the new homes because they would stay in there for 30, 40 years and pay the mortgage off. But where white people were concerned, you could force blacks in on them, and then they would buy the new developments that you built for them and sell blacks the older homes. It still exists today. It's the same process.
Let me talk about another aspect of this collusion, so-called. For lots of years, it was almost impossible for a white person willing and able to move to a neighborhood like Windsor Hills, which was changing, to get a mortgage. It got so bad that in 1961, Baltimore Neighborhoods, Inc., which is an integrationist organization, wanted to set up a $1 million loan fund just to get money for whites. I mean, blacks were getting financing. Whites were not in changing neighborhoods. And there is still an organization in Philadelphia, a nationwide organization, that is giving mortgage money to people whose race is unrepresented in a given neighborhood because it is so difficult to get these loans.
So, but you're talking about that was a conscious effort to keep a neighborhood interracial.
No, it was affirmative action by funds like the Philadelphia Fund was a conscious effort to keep a neighborhood interracial, but the regular banking industry wanted it to go one race.
And when did that? But that practice is, I mean, not on the books now. We're not doing that. At least we're not doing that openly now.
We are not doing it openly now. And I think that this is another thing that has changed dramatically as a result of the kind of freewheeling mortgage activity that we saw during the past 10 years. I mean. in many ways, it was a very destructive phenomenon. But in racial terms, it enabled both blacks to move to the suburbs and whites who so desired to look for houses in neighborhoods where they thought that the houses were beautiful. Gentrification seemed to be on the books. I mean, before that, you couldn't do it. I mean, look at New York in Harlem now, news to many people, right, is substantially white.
I mean, so when we're talking about class, money, and race here when it comes to our segregated neighborhoods, let me go back to the phones and I'll come back to that topic and where we sit with it in the 21st century. 410-319-8888. Thanks, Tommy. And Billy, you're on the air.
Hey, Mark. I always listen to your program. I never call, but this is a subject that I felt obligated to call about.
Okay.
My situation is I live in Baltimore County, just over the Baltimore line, and I came here in 1960 and built a home in 1965. I had to build a home because I was living in an apartment. My first child was about to be born, and I had to get out. And I could not find any place to build, and so I went to this neighborhood by luck, Bear Hills, just over the Baltimore city line.
Mm-hmm.
And it was an all-black neighborhood at that time. And I was fortunate enough to find some property there that I could build my home and have lived there since 1965 and enjoyed every minute of it. But I want to talk about that neighborhood. That was the property was owned by a man then named Godman. So Godman owned that property, and he insisted that one of the things that we must do is sell the property to of the blacks. Well, since that has happened, what you didn't know now, that neighborhood of about 30 homes, at least 50% of them now white owned, mixed couples, and we get along just fine.
What neighborhood is it?
It's Bear Hills.
Oh, okay.
It's all off the 6200 block of Falls Road.
Right.
And I love it. I love it dearly. And I love my neighbors, and they have, I came here from the South, so I know what segregation was and what it was all about. But we have neighbors now that it's just unbelievable how close-knit they are. And you know how close-knit people are when you have a situation like the snowstorm that we just had and how they pitch in and help you.
This is kind of complexity of what you're talking about, the neighborhood you're talking about, Billy, and the... The neighborhood you're talking about, I think I know the neighborhood, Bear Hills, was historically an all-black neighborhood.
That's correct.
One of the neighborhoods set aside for black folks to live in post-segregation era, in post-slavery era.
And a certain section of Falls Road was like that where Poly Weston is now.
Right across the street.
Yes.
At Cold Spring and what's now Northern Parkway.
Right.
That was an all-black enclave.
All-black,
and there was
right.
another one similar to that in Mount Washington,
that's
where the
true.
Old AME church used to be.
Right.
That's now somebody's house, the
right.
old AME church.
Right.
But what's interesting and what Billy is saying is now that neighborhood, there's a phenomenon going on with these old black neighborhoods like that, historically black neighborhoods with really lovely homes, stable neighborhoods for over 100 and some years, are either being mixed like Billy's saying his neighborhood is, or they're being bought up and black. There are no black folks left in those neighborhoods.
There are a few blacks there. But... Here again is price and location. They're in Baltimore County, and you're just across the line. It doesn't take, and the cost of taxes and everything else are less expensive, so they would really go to a neighborhood like that.
But it's Billy. Very quickly, do you think your neighborhood is stabilized as a mixed neighborhood at the moment?
Yes, it is. It's very stable, and my neighbors are probably 50% white, and we get along just fine, and we don't feel the stings of segregation as I did when I first came here.
Well, maybe I'll have to come on and pay a visit to your neighborhood, talk to some folks. That's great. Thank you so much, Billy, for joining us.
Thank you.
410-319-8888. Dennis, you're on the air.
Mark, Dennis Livingston.
Hey, how are you, man?
Good.
Good.
I just wanted to point out that historically the black neighborhoods in this city, when they had jobs at the steel mill and construction and shipbuilding, were incredibly healthy and some of the safest neighborhoods in the city. It was the demise of the industry that has created the problem, and crime and drugs and education and bad housing are all symptoms of a lack of industry. And Baltimore is now doing almost nothing to bring that industry back, in spite of the fact that we have more underused industrial space than any city in the country. And a perfect example is that $16 million just came into the city for weatherization.
Mm-hmm.
At most, one of the 11 contractors is a minority contractor from Baltimore City. All that money is going back out into the county. And if you can't, if you cannot even keep federal stimulus money in the city that was specifically made to rebuild our economy, and you let all that go out to the county, you're doomed to not rebuild the industrial base. And you look at Sandton Winchester, and you see $80 million going into a community, nothing going into jobs. People get the houses at a discount, and then they lose them because
right.
they don't have a job. Imagine if a fraction of that went to helping small companies be developed in those neighborhoods. And unless the city shifts its focus to creating good jobs for people, all the neighborhoods are going to suffer. There's going to be this tremendous disparity between low-income neighborhoods and rich neighborhoods that's just growing.
Dennis, it's good to hear your voice. We need to get you in the studio. I'm serious. Joan?
I think this is probably a conversation Dennis and I started having, I don't know, 35 years ago. But I think he's right. I think he's absolutely right. And there's no job development. That's very interesting what he said about the weatherization money going to contractors from the suburbs. And the only thing I wanted to add to what he said is that I think drugs has really driven some of these poor neighborhoods into the ground. I think rather than the loss of jobs being the catalyst, I think in many cases the drug addiction, the heroin wars, drove the neighborhoods into the ground.
Now, but is there a relationship for the three of what Dennis was saying, some other callers have said, between the lack of industry, lack of work, and racial segregation in jobs? I mean, racial segregation in neighborhoods. Is there a connection here?
Well, there certainly is a connection between that and deterioration of neighborhoods. And just look at the dilemma of churches, now black churches. It used to be white churches in the first go-around. Now it's black churches. They are catering to a congregation that is commuting from the suburbs, and ultimately they will move.
Right.
And so another anchor in a neighborhood is lost.
Jim, you about to say something?
I read the Sun paper this morning about the governor trying to get the General Assembly to do something about foreclosures, which is very important. But at the end of this month, in the Sun paper, there will be thousands of houses that will be going up for tax sale.
Mm-hmm.
It would appear to me that while we're discussing the economic conditions of the city and housing, that the city would foreclose the tax sale this year or move it back to maybe June the 15th to give people an opportunity to pay their taxes.
And keep their homes.
And keep their homes.
I mean, one of the things that we're going to talk about in part of the next hour is just what the federal government could do and what it could have done when the whole housing market blew up and we were faced with this huge deficit and then we had to bail out the bank, is at that moment the government could have forced the banks, because they could have forced the banks at that moment to do anything because they had them by certain parts of their body that they will remain nameless on the air, but they had them. And they could have insisted that the banks write the principals on those mortgages down so that people could stay in their homes and we could still have people having homeowners and have a thriving communities. But they didn't do that. But that's what it takes if they want to keep people in these homes. And well, let me go back to the phones here and get your thoughts on that. 410-319-8888. Alfred, you're on the air.
Hello, Mark Steiner?
Yes, you're on the air.
Good to hear your voice. Listen,
yours.
I want to hear some perspectives on what we could actually do to stop the real cause of these social problems. It appears that we have a magnificent place for a sociologist to study the conflict paradigm, that theory, because that's what's happening. These things that we're talking about didn't happen by accident or organically, naturally happened. They're designed, and all from the crime, from the drugs. We all know Oliver North was convicted and not pardoned or overturned for bringing the drugs into these communities. And there's no accident that the jobs and the disenfranchisement of certain and particular communities, much of this is done by design. Some people have profited. Forgive me for not being able to name certain organizations or politicians or certain persons involved. Over at the Bloomberg School at Johns Hopkins, there's a toxic tour that a community leader gives to groups and
oh yes, right, that's right, right, right.
And that particular leader, I've worked with him a little bit, and he actually can give you a certain politicians, as I said, and other investors who are part of actually bringing communities to demise, so that once the community, the members of the community cannot, basically they play percentages because, as many of the people on your panel are saying, people are going to move out if they can. But they're going to leave people behind. They're going to be victims because these are the ones who may not have the mental capability to read through or see their way out to the county or to better places or even to protect themselves where they are.
Well, Alfred, let me go back to the panel for a minute. And what we think about what happened in that period with folks left behind and where we are in 2010. I mean, there was a period in Baltimore when industry collapsed. People lost their jobs of all kinds, from box factories to Bethlehem Steel. But there were a certain body of folks in the black community who had jobs, went to college, segregation ended, things began to change. But then the answer was to leave. So folks left, moved to Baltimore County, moved out to the suburbs, and the dislocated were left. And after three or four generations of dislocation for the last 50 years in those neighborhoods, we see the devastation that it's wrought. Now, I don't know if it was a conscious effort, but it clearly is what happened.
Started in 1954 with the Supreme Court's decision about segregation, integration of the schools, where they took the best. Let me tell you, I went to Douglas High School. I went to all the schools I attended in the city of Baltimore were absolutely black. We had a superintendent of black schools. His name was Francis M. Wood. He was the president of the University of Kentucky. He never attended the school board meetings at 3 East 25th Street. They placed a chair on the outside of the door when the meetings were being conducted, and he listened to the conversations. After the meeting adjourned, when they walked out and saw him sitting in the hall, they would have to go back into the meeting, restart the meeting, and then decide what they're going to do for black schools. It's a matter of education. If people are educated and they know that this is where they have to live or where they want to live, they will protect the community and not have all of the strange things that come into the community that spoils the community.
Let me go back to the phone to one of our callers, and we're going to get to all of you calling in at 410-319-8888. I recognize the name as somebody I think was in your article, Joan Jacobson, and I'd like to hear her thoughts. Shanaysia, you're on the air.
Great.
Thank you. Hi, Joan. How are you?
Hi, Shanaysia. Good to hear your voice. I'm glad you called in.
Oh, I wouldn't have missed the interview. I just want to thank you for the article. Thank you for the story.
Thank you.
All of you. I'm enjoying hearing your perspectives. And I just want to say that, our block is a very special block, and Joan has sort of captured that very well. But, I would never say that the racial and socioeconomic differences in the community are perfect. And I think as a neighborhood, Patterson Park, we sort of struggle to be a community of different races, cultures, socioeconomic communities. I think that a part of our task is to figure out how the old and new and their various shades can sort of come together and understand that no one deserves to live here any more than anyone else. We would hope that other families and households would sort of reinvest in the city, and which would include reinvesting in their neighborhoods and particularly in the schools of Baltimore City. I am not a native of Baltimore. I'm married to a native of Baltimore. And, you know, I have thoroughly enjoyed my 7 years in Baltimore City. So I just wanted to know, thank you, Joan, for the article. Thank you for the story and the interview, and I'll just listen offline. So, and I should also say that Lester Spence, it turns out, is a friend of ours.
Lester's a great guy.
World, I did not realize that he wrote an article.
That's why they call it Smaltimore.
He and I are friends, and my husband and he are actually friends. They're members of the same fraternity.
Well, that's just one of the smartest guys I know. He's just brilliant. That's why he's our guest on the show, as much as I can get him on the air with us. But I'm curious, tell me what you think of not just the article, but of your neighborhood and how, A, stable it is as an interracial neighborhood, and will stay that way, and B, one of the things positive at the beginning of the hour was part of it has to do with the younger generation and different attitudes towards race and living?
Well, you know, I think that's right. I mean, I think as a neighborhood, we have to come to grips that we're not going to be Canton. And I think that some of us are more or less comfortable with that fact than others. I'm talking about the neighborhood as a whole.
Mm-hmm.
I think that probably at a period of time, maybe 2005, 2006, the expectation would be that Patterson Park would sort of become an alternative to Canton, and all of what that might mean for a professional class that would be largely white, quite frankly, considering a move to Baltimore City and where they would live downtown. Probably because of the housing crisis, Patterson Park is still sort of considered, I think it's a healthy neighborhood, which would mean that it's a neighborhood that's stabilizing, but it's still vulnerable, somewhat vulnerable, so it could sort of go either way. I think that this actually presents a tremendous opportunity where, as a community, we figure out how we live together, all of us. So whether that's a Greek neighbor who has lived here for 40 years or so, or that is a Latino couple and their family, three generations sometimes, that have sort of invested here, and we all send our kids to the same community schools. I mean, I think that we're figuring that out. But I would have to say that I think the expectation was for a while that the notion of Patterson Park would stabilize the neighborhood in the way that Canton has stabilized and branded itself as a neighborhood. And I think that there has been some struggle over, I think, regional, cultural, different ways of operating in the city, whether that's sort of modes of transportation, whether that's issues of, you know, how you address grievances with neighbors, how you navigate the political landscape in terms of getting things done. But I think that, you know, all things told, I think that as a neighborhood we're coming to terms, that is, Patterson Park is coming to terms to what we are, and we're sort of embracing what that will mean in terms of our diversity, you know, racially, culturally, and so on. So.
Shanesha, I'm glad you joined us for a few minutes here, and I was saying to Joan before the show that I look forward to getting you and your husband and some of your neighbors on this show in studio to talk about the neighborhood and your thoughts on all of that.
Okay, well, thank you so much.
We'd love that.
All
thank
right,
you, so
you all have a great night.
First, again, Joan Jacobson, thank you so much for the article you wrote.
Thank you for having me on.
You can spur at least two shows on here. It's a good thing. Anthorop Beathelis, good to see you. Looking forward to having you back on for your book.
Thank you.
And Jim Crockett, always a pleasure to have you grace our studios. Good to see you, my friend.
Thank you.
Good to have you here. We're going to take a very brief break. I want to remind you the Mark Steiner Show is made possible by the Maryland State Mortgage Late Don't Wait program. For more information and personal counseling, the number is 1-877-462-7555. Stay with us. We're going to talk about this economy and what some reality check for all of us about what we have to do to make it right in America with leading economist Dean Baker. One of our series of conversations we're going to start having with leading economists from around the world talking about the future of our nation and planet. And then some other surprises towards the end of the hour. Stay with us. We'll be right back.